Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. You're a sysadmin, working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, computer tech, you want to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is a very special day. Not only have we had a solar eclipse, the moon is at perigee, and the spring equinox, it's also the day of episode 19 of the Admin Admin podcast. So what's everyone been up to this week?
Well, I've been kind of doing quite a lot of research. I've got a customer who's got merging. Well, they've brought another company and we've got to merge the domains. So it's kind of, I've never done it properly before about merging domains. They basically got two Exchange servers and we're going to merge the Exchange servers and the Adderator. But I'm going to talk about that at the end if we get time today. So what's other people been up to then?
Well, I've been off work most of the week, so not all that much to report. But long-time listeners will be glad to know that I've got that guy's web server and mail server sorted out from last week. The way I did it was by bypassing Plesk and just doing the configuration by hand, so still a bit more to sort out there, but it's a bit of a cautionary tale about using a control panel that you don't really know what it's doing. So,
do you have to take a week off work to fix it then?
Oh no, I had to take a week off work for sort of family reasons, I was intending to do some freelance work with my time off, but I've just been rushing around the whole time, so ferrying kids around and stuff. But such is life.
Jerry, you Andy. Sorry.
I'm Andy. You're
and
Jerry.
I'm Gary.
Mate, we were doing it half an hour later than we're annoying it. I should be.
I think it's the moon perigee is messing our brains up in some way. So this week, I went back to that youth club that we did. You've looked at it with me, haven't we? With the backup. Yep. I remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about that backup drive that wouldn't be seen.
Yeah.
Well, after we got that sorted, it was only back there this week. So I thought I'd check out how that backup's going and whether it's still successful or not, which it is. So it's a small business server, 2008, and it's still doing the backup. Everything seems to be fine. One thing I did notice after the last week's episode was the first day it did a full backup, and then each other day's backup has been labelled as incremental.
Yep.
But what I don't know if what it does is the one full backup right the first time it's ever done, and then every other backup is incremental, or does it do a full backup every week and then incremental throughout the week? I'm not sure how it works. I was going to have a look, but I had other things to do, so I never get a chance.
All right. Depending on how it's being configured, I don't normally, with the Veeam stuff, it is like we talk about forever incremental, so it never does another full backup. But I'm guessing you can probably configure it to do once on a Sunday, perhaps.
I never told it to do anything. That's just how it's done it itself. No wonder the wizard. So we're assuming that, are we then? It's one full backup and incremental from that point on.
Okay, we'll have a look. So.
But we can look into it. I was going to look to see if I had any kind of idea about it, but I didn't have a chance to. But
Did it email you if it backs up at all? Have you configured that part? Because it's always good to check your backups, get the email or whatever.
I haven't, no. But it is a good idea to do. Even though they have not yet, going back to the same old story, they have not yet paid me to do any maintenance on their stuff whatsoever.
Yeah. So,
as we're speaking at the minute, I'm doing it. I'm doing this backup because they did get me to put a drive on and set up a backup because he had nothing beforehand. So that's why I'm doing that. But I might configure it just for my own benefit, just to see if it works.
Yeah.
But they haven't paid me to monitor it or make sure this is doing it or doing any other stuff yet. So
yeah.
But hopefully they will, and then we'll get into that. But next time I'm down there, I'll see if I can configure an email backup.
It's always good to get email backups. We have like a spreadsheet and stuff at work. We just tick off.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's just for me. It's good just to do it, just mm-hmm. to see it working and to see the, you know, the success of it or the no success of it. Even though they're not paying me for it, it's kind of like learning on the job, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, right. Well, that's one thing. Now, another thing I've been doing. This has been at home. Because at home I use my virtual machines or in VirtualBox at home, and I was wondering if you either you knew the difference between these two, and why, and the effects that it's having. I'd been running some virtual machines on this very computer we're on at the minute, and the first time I'd done them, I'd created them. Either Linux one or Ubuntu one or a Windows one as a VHD file, which I presume stands for virtual hard drive. Everything loaded and everything, but that particular image was just really, really slow. I was looking something up, and somebody had done it as a VMDK file.
Yeah.
Which I presume stands for virtual machine disk.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, you know what, I'm just going to try it. So I made an image as a VMDK file, and I loaded Windows onto it, and it was instantly 10 times quicker.
Okay.
So that's my query. What's the difference between a VHD and a VMDK, and why do you think it's having such an adverse effect?
VMDK is what the standard what you use in VMware, so okay. So I don't know why it'd be any faster kind of thing between the two. Is that using VirtualBox or?
Yeah.
Is VHD the VirtualBox specific format then?
It might be. I mean, I just assumed it was virtual hard disk, you could set them as dynamic or static as well. I mean, it's not an issue because now I've got them running as VMDK files. I could convert them. And they're all running fine now. But I was just curious to know or have a reason why it was so slow under the other version.
So VHD is the VirtualBox specific, you'd think it'd be faster because VMDK is basically a foreign disk format. But
right.
yeah, I don't know.
It says VHD is the native format of the Microsoft
I can't remember.
Virtual PC, apparently.
It's a native one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sure VirtualBox has its own as well. Or it can use something called OVF. I know that's a sort of open standard, open virtualization format or something it stands for.
Another thing that may have been an issue, what I was thinking is because I'm running it on two drives, you see, that my main drive, which has VirtualBox on, is an SSD drive, but the images that I'm using, I'm keeping on a standard drive because it's so much bigger, you see. And I was just wondering if there was any kind of issue with that. I didn't have the space to put it on the SSD drive, you see.
VMware's been around for a lot longer, and they've probably got a better disk image for that.
VMware you have to buy, don't you? How much is that, roughly? Do you know?
Well, it depends what you want to go for. So you get VMware player, which is free, which you can do limited bits with it, and then you get the Fusion or whatever, or workstations when you have to pay for the back. Well, about £200, I think. But it says here, disk image, normally VirtualBox uses its own container format for guest hard drive, which is VDI files. VirtualBox also fully supports the VHD format used by Microsoft, and VirtualBox also supports the popular and open VMDK container format, which is used by many other virtual products, in particular VMware. So it's guessing if you have different formats, you can basically just plop the hard drive onto another system, So if you had it in your virtual box and then move it over to something else, like a VMware thing, you can then access it. I'd use the VMDK file, because if you wanted to move anywhere else, you've got those files. Do you actually have to use a command line to convert them, or?
No. No. You're just in the properties of that particular machine. You go to the settings of it, and then it's under the storage tab, and then you can change it from there. The controller is what it's calling it.
Okay, cool. So you basically just put a new image and then reinstalled the window, did you? Or
yeah, I mean, it was an issue. Remember, was it last week sometime when we were talking and I was on a virtual machine?
Yeah.
And it was really slow.
Yeah.
And we thought it was to do with the static disk size, and it was full.
Yeah.
That was the one. That was on a VHD file.
Okay.
And it was really slow. And now I've put them on a VMDK file. It's just like normal, you know. So
maybe it's got trouble issue writing VHD files to your disk, and that's why it's better. That's why it's better to have the VMDK for the VDI file. So
yeah, I mean, I solved the problem. That wasn't the issue. I was just really wondering why. but yeah, so that was one other thing I've been doing this week. I also saw this week. Remember last week we were talking about those people who had bought that PC, that laptop, and they'd got the bundle with all those bits in.
Yep.
I saw an advert on the TV, World bundle, was £99. So that's what they'd been given as the bundle. So they got 365, McAfee, and online backup for £99.
Is that a yearly thing, though?
Because they bought that for all those three things. So after a year, you'd have to resubscribe to all of them, wouldn't you? Which would probably cost more than £99 in the second year. So, so that was that. I was also looking into looking a bit more into doing this Pixie server thing we were talking about last week as well.
Yep.
And one thing I read, and I didn't know how all this would fit into it, because we've done a show on this before, but one of the things that was quoted, it said that a Pixie server needs to have its own DHCP and therefore needs to turn off the DHCP in the router or server or wherever you're using. That's what I read, and I thought that seems like a lot of hassle to go through just to make a Pixie server. So I don't know if anyone else had a... had a look at that this week at all, or
not really? But you... go ahead, Andy.
Go ahead.
Right. Okay. We were saying, Do you need your own DHCP server? But you need to make sure it supports the option what tells it where your Pixie Boot server is. So, your normal root router at home from BT or whatever won't have that option in it to tell it where the Pixie Boot server is.
All right.
So when it comes up, your server will go, right, or your PC, sorry, okay, right, give me an IP address, and then also tell me where the Pixie Boot server is so I can go along and pick up. If you're running a Windows 2000 or whatever, Windows server, there's an option. I can't remember what the option is, what the Pixie Boot option is off the top of my head, but it's like an option. And normally, like, if you have your own, if you like doing the Microsoft deployment server, when you set it up, there's an option, it automatically sets DHCP settings. So you just got to have a DHCP server which supports the setting options in it. So you can do things like DHCP. You can set things like where the time server is. You know, like when you get your DHCP, it gives you your default gateway and your DNS server. But also you can tell it, right, this is what my NTP server is, and then you can tell it to do different things. So I'm just having a look. See, I think it's option 60 or something, which you set, or 66, sorry, to tell you what the TFTP server is to use a Pixie Boot server, basically.
I was just thinking, in the house, you know, to make a separate internal network.
You could do.
Cables separately completely, all through a switch or something. Just for reloading images, because I wouldn't have to connect it up to my standard network. Just have a separate network in local.
A VLANs for that, so that you can DHCP. You can have set this IP helper thing, and it will that's going down a rabbit hole a bit further with the Pixie booting. So. I just get it working on a sort of flat network first, and then worry about things like that.
Yeah, get if you get a layer 3 switch, but you're talking a bit of money for that, like 100, 200 quid for a switch, so we're going to start talking being IP here, helper and stuff. So is that all you...
Yeah.
So, Andy, Andy, I got off. Anything else to report then? Is that where Andy?
Nothing recent this week, man. Over to you, Jim.
Yeah, except it's been really sunny today, and I don't know, it's feel really warm in my house. I don't know, it's surprising what making when the spring comes and the sun gets out actually makes life feel a lot more better.
That's it. From tomorrow on,
it's really grey down
longer
here.
Longer day than
the
night.
Eclipse.
Apart from those poor people in the southern hemisphere.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Okay.
Well, mind you, they've just had 6 months of summer, so I don't feel that sorry for them.
So, I was going to say a couple of things off on that this week. Listened to one of those radio podcasts, and he had a couple of kind of programs on there, which you kind of have, which you can have in your back pocket for the Windows admins. What is this called? Problem Step Recorder. If you just go start run on Windows 7 and above, and you go psr.exe. It brings up this problem step recorder, and it basically you press record and it goes off, and you just go around and start clicking stuff and just record what you're doing, so you can use it to actually document something of how you set something up, and when you finish it, it basically puts it into a spreadsheet, a Word document, and it basically puts all the screenshots of all the things you've clicked. So it's quite handy for that. So it like kind of records all your steps. So you haven't got to sit there and do. If you're doing some documentation, you can just.
That sounds brilliant. Now, what was the command line for that again?
I think it's just psr.exe. Just click and start run. Type in the run box psr.exe. So
PSR should do it. Or
yeah. So. That's one good thing. And then another thing he was talking about in the application on this program was this thing called Performer Analyzer of Logs applications. Like, these are all in CodePlex. It's basically a Microsoft site where people put their own code up. Okay. And, you know, like you can use Performance Monitor on a Windows box and you can see, like, how many, the latency of the hard drive is or how many requests are being waiting or CPU time. But obviously you can record all that into like a text file and then analyze it. But the problem is, how do you analyze it? What do you? You should really do a baseline, and you can do a baseline compared to another one. But what you can do is this Performance Analyzer of Logs. It's a program what Microsoft, someone from the Microsoft support team, and you import the output from the performance monitor, and it basically looks at and tells you what's wrong with it. So, like the guy's example was that this guy was saying that it was slow disk performance, and they put like recommendations in it. So that's quite handy. There's also another one for Exchange as well. So when you do performance logs from Exchange, you can do it as well. And also there's a SQL monitor as well, which you can run live on the target SQL server, and it will tell you what's happening with your SQL server, what's causing it wrong, or there's like being locked on database or whatever, which is a normal case for slow databases. So these are all good things to have in your back pocket. I haven't had a chance to actually look at any of these applications yet. Good things you can keep in your back pocket. Also, Microsoft Comp is a Active Directory replication status tool. So you probably heard me talk about my tools I use to see how good AD is replicating and everything has no issues. using like Repmon and stuff. Well, there's actually a visual tool. I haven't actually had a chance to download and have a look at it yet. But yeah, that's another thing to keep in your back pocket. It's kind of like a graphical Repmon, and it basically shows you how the replications go between servers, how long the last one is, and if there's any errors. So that's quite good. I wanted to ask, have any of you ever used RescueDD before?
No, I haven't. RescueDD?
No.
I listened to another podcast, and someone was saying I think it's just like a DD version, but like it just skips bad point or bad sectors, and then goes back and tries the sectors after it. Because someone was saying, like, if you're trying to do some hardware recovery, you basically, if you've got like a failing hard drive, you don't want to try and do any changes on the data. You just want to literally just try and read it once, get a good copy of it, and then once you've got a DD of it, you can then use your tools to get those files out of it, basically.
Mm. I mean, you can do things like error correction, yeah, can't you, on bad bits.
That's something else I need to have a look at, really, DD Rescue. Looks like it's a good tool to make a disk image of the thing. So, like, if you want to see photo rec on it or whatever to get photos back, you're not damaging the hard drive. You're using it from the tools, the actual DD. Yeah, so we've had quite a lot of emails in since our last show last week. So,
okay. So, the first one, who's the first one from?
I think it's from Simon.
Simon, yeah, there we go.
Long time listening.
Did you know you shouldn't use root add in 2008? We had a server setup that we found became unavailable on the network down to some routing issues, and Martin thinks he found the solution below. The default gateway is set to a router so it can get outside to the outside world and for net rules to SMTP. And then, unlike a lot of standard setups, it has a persistent route added which points to a different address which enables the server to reach other subnets internally. To fix this, the persistent routes had to be removed and added again. Weird, eh? The solution, apparently, is not to use the root add command, because this can just fail after a time. And if you still see them added in when you do a root point. What you should do instead is to use the netsh command. Have you come across this before? Maybe want to mention to your listeners. And he's put in a few articles with some links on, so we'll have to put those in the show notes. So if you want to go and check them out, then you can do. So that's from Simon.
Yeah, there's a bit, he's come back with like a relevant part. It says, with Windows 2008 and Windows 2008 R2, the recommendation is to manage static routes has changed. Although root add should work, the management of routes has technically been replaced with the function netsh. Therefore, it is recommended with the netsh command be utilized to implement and manage static routes. Right, so it says the first step in implementing static routes with the netsh command is to determine the interface name. The interface name is the logical name assigned to network connection. For example, local area connection 1. It is recommended that these connections are named as something more logical. For example, LAN replication A, logical network may be the same on all nodes. So this is my mate Simon, who's the guy who came on to talk about NTP. He emailed me. So what this is talking about is that, let's say you have got a server and you've got your router, but the router you've got on your network can't do nice routing. So let's say that inside your network you've got another network you need to get to. So let's say you've got your internal network is 192.168.2.0/24, but also you might have something, I don't know, like a CCTV network which is on the same network, which is like 192.168.3.0, and so you've got like a little router, like a little Cisco router, one of my MikroTiks, which has got a leg into each network. So let's say so you've got a leg into each network, so the leg into the normal network is like 192.168. 192.168.3.10, and then in the other network it's 192.168.3.10. And obviously if you're on the server and you want to get to the .3 network, normally by default gateway rules, it will go to your router, and then your router will tell you where to go. But if your router is not very clever and doesn't know about the other network, you can type a command, which I've never had a problem with before until Simon emailed in, as you do a command called root add. And what that does is it tells the server or the PC where their network is. So you would go root add, this is from the top of my memory, root add, I think you do, one, you tell it what the network is, so it'd be 192.168.3.0, then you put the mask in 255.255.0, and then you tell it what the gateway address is. So that's the little router I was telling you about a minute ago, and you put that as 192.168.2.10, and then you must remember that if you just click return, then it will put it in, but when you reboot the PC or server, it will get lost. So you need to put a minus P on the end of that. And what that basically does is if you do a root table, so if you do root space print in a command line, it will give you all the roots. And that's basically telling you that when your PC goes, right, I want to speak to something on the 192.168.3. range, it goes, right, I know I've got to send it down to 192.168.2.10 and then send. I might have said that command wrong with a, so you put the default, whatever the root is, to the IP address of that leg. So that's 192.168.2.10. So I might have said that wrong. So what Simon says is that he's found out that he had a lot of issues where it kept dropping out. So they're saying that in 2008R, 2008R2 and above, you should use a netsh command, which is basically a way of configuring network adapters and stuff. So it's just a way of doing it. So he's recommending that Microsoft is saying that you should use netsh command to configure a static root and not the root add command, as he said. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, the whole routing thing, the actual routing table part, I always get confused with. But, I mean, the concept of routing is quite easy. You've got your network that your host is on, and if it has to get a packet to a network that it doesn't know about, then it will just go to the default gateway by default, which will then route it to wherever it needs to go. But then if you've got a fancy network set up inside your LAN, you've got other networks inside your LAN, it might need to know about other gateways to other to those bits of the network on your LAN. So, but yeah, I've never really got on with routing tables in Linux either. So maybe it's something I just never sort of learnt the syntax of the commands and so on. But it's similar. There's a root command in Linux, which is probably possibly where Microsoft got it from, like the nslookup yeah. command. So.
No, I like my. I love networking and stuff. That's why I like playing with networks and stuff and getting things configured. So cool. Okay, so that's another question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say networking is very simple in principle when you learn about it, but working out when something's not quite right and then trying to fix it, and also remembering all the commands for the switches, I find that quite challenging. But maybe it's because I don't do it every day.
It's the same with me with Linux, is remembering the commands.
Yeah. What about, I mean, it's one thing to set up your own. Now, if you set up a network and you designed it, and all the ins and outs of it, but what's it like when you come into a system that you've never seen before? It must be like a rat's nest to begin with until you figure it all out. That must be a difficult... Or is that something you just get used to, or do you have a method for...
Welcome to my world, Andy.
In the first place, I suppose.
That's the bit I like doing. That's the bit I like getting my hands in it. In my kind of get my brain ran, work out how it's all working and stuff.
You've got to figure out what somebody else was thinking.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's normally the case that someone's not, normally the case that someone doesn't know what they're doing, basically.
Do you find like a lot of add-ins? So something's been designed initially, and then over time, this has been added, that's been added, this has been added, that's been added. And each individual add-in is maybe insignificant and quite minor. But when you add them all up, they just become a rat's nest.
Yes.
Hell.
Okay, so what's the next email there?
We found a client.
Yep, we've got another email. This is from Chris in Palmerston North, New Zealand. So, a message from people just going into the winter months. Okay, right. Hi, guys. As a sysadmin for a wide range of businesses, I listen to all of your podcasts with interest. The last episode about backups has prompted me to add some input with regards to Windows servers. As an IT company, we use Shadow Protect from StorageCraft, and he has provided the a link to it, as a backup regime of choice for the companies that we support. The backups are typically stored on a NAS box that is situated as far away from the server as possible. There is also an option to send the incrementals to the cloud as well. It is usual setup to initially make one full backup and then incremental backups every 15 minutes for data that has changed since the last one. These backups will only take a minute to run. As you imagine, there will be a long tail of incremental backups each day. StorageCraft have an application called Image Manager, which will make the incremental backups for each day and combined into a daily backup file, and eventually it creates a weekly and monthly file. The originals are then deleted. I will usually schedule a daily copy of these files to be sent to an external USB drive and removed from site each night, so that the business always has a copy of the backup of the previous day off-site. For disaster recovery purposes, when the server failed, the image can be virtually booted into VirtualBox on another machine or even a laptop, and the system can be temporarily restored very quickly. While the original server fault is fixed, the individual backups can be mounted, treated like a drive, should you need to recover a lost file. 3 years ago, Christchurch in New Zealand had a catastrophic earthquake that killed over 180 people. The memorable image was of a guy in a suit walking through the rubble, covered in dust, just after the quake, with a server under his arm. After that event, the importance of off-site backup was really illustrated, as a lot of companies found that they could not function effectively without their data. Okay, another story. I took over the support of a large real estate company a couple of years ago and was checking how they did their off-site backups. The receptionist proudly showed me a heavily external backup hard drive and power jack that she had routinely carried in her handbag each night for the past 3 years. When I checked the drive, all I found was a shortcut file to my documents. Whoever had set up the backup had only backed up the shortcut and not the actual file. It's also very important to check that you can restore files as well as back up as well. Anyway, enough ramblings. Love the show and look forward to your next show. And that's Chris from New Zealand. That's a good email. A couple of good stories there.
Yeah.
The shortcut to my documents.
So he's going on about this Shadow Protect software. I know that Mike Tech always sells that to his customer. I never used it, so I don't know how good it is. It seems to be good. I think you can basically, using VirtualBox or Hyper-V, you can kind of bring the machine back up, like a bit like my Veeam software. So, yeah, I must have to check that out. I think you can even get it for workstations, so you can sell it to someone, and then it can basically... You can have it on your workstation if they haven't got a server, and then it can, But if your server dies, it can be. It's that thing where you can bring it on up on any hardware again. So you haven't got to worry about what hardware you've got. So I don't know how much, if it's expensive or not. So it's very interesting bit of software. Yeah, and then again, is checking your backups work. We didn't really go over this last week after we did the backup. Is that, yeah, it's always make sure that your backups work. You need to have a restore plan. I mean, a lot of my time, a couple of my old jobs was that we actually tested the backups work so that we had 130 dental practices and they each had a little DAT drive. So we made sure that every 6 months the each site send their tape back to us and we'd restore their data. And it's surprising how many data you couldn't actually restore from those tapes, because a lot of the old, really old DDS tapes is that it was an alignment, so you'd only ever really be able to restore it from the same backup. But we actually found out a couple of dead drives, or that these it makes you actually know that you're actually restoring can be restored okay. And also things like coming up with a backup plan of how you actually restore yourself. Because I know a lot of times when you like try and restore Active Directory or Exchange, you get loads of issues which you don't know about. But at least if you do like in a test environment, so even if with virtualization it's quite cool, if you don't have to have the full brunt of your full production servers, that you can have get a server off eBay or something, or not so high spec server, and actually restore your data to that server off the network, so you have your own little network which is not connected to your domain or your live network, so that you can actually see that everything's working. And then we did DR documents and stuff so that you can go in there, and so that if you have a DR problem, you know what you're actually going to be, how you're going to restore. And then we did a DR test every month with our backups to make sure that nothing had changed. And if anything had changed, we can then update the documentation. Interesting as well, a couple of years ago, we were restoring a web server and doing this DR test, and we couldn't get it restored everything except the web server component. And this is not using backup, it's using a product called ArcServe, which was a good product in the day. And it took me about a month to get through to someone at support, and we got through the hoops. And I actually found a bug in their software that when they actually did a restore, wouldn't actually restore in the IIS database. So, yeah. So if my server had died, I wouldn't be able to get my web server back. But that's a good way of testing your backup, because this is where I found out there's a fault that took them about a month for the people at ArcServe to realise, acknowledge that there was actually an issue with the backup, with their backup software, when someone wanted to restore their IIS web server. Anyone got anything to add about that? About doing test backups or?
not maybe I haven't done it as much as I should have done. You sound a lot more prepared than I am. However, in my defence, every restore that I've done has worked. So. That's something, I suppose.
Maybe the new phrase, instead of backup, test backup. No, backup, test backup. Backup, test backup.
Yes.
But it is just as important. In fact, it's more important to be able to restore it than it is to back it up in the first place. You know, what's the use of a backup if you can't restore it? Or if you do restore it, it doesn't work.
The data is corrupt or something.
Yeah, so you may as well not do it in the first place. So, but yeah, and it's a good idea to have a test environment where you can just simulate it. Mm-hmm. You know, places have fire alarm tests on a monthly basis or whatever they do. So why can't they have a server down test or a backup test? So,
it's a good idea.
Okay, have we got any more emails? I think we've got two more emails left, haven't we?
Oh, yeah. So this is from Ronnie, just a quick one. He said, I subscribed to to iTunes, and it won't pull episodes 1 to 7. Same with the RSS. So that's what Ronnie said. So have you got any news on that, or know why?
I'm a bit worried about changing it, because by default while we're using WordPress for our website is by default it only keeps 10 items in the first page of the website. So what you do is you create your post, and then it creates an RSS feed, and then Google, I can't think what the Google thing is, at the RSS feed, it basically pulls that data into an RSS feed, whatever's in that 10 page. And obviously that's why you can only see 7, because it's only got the last 10 episodes, and obviously we've done 17, 18 episodes. I can update that so it's more than 10, but I'm a bit worried that if I do that and then it puts more than 10 on there, do you think that people then start downloading, which haven't, will start downloading the other files, if you see what I mean? I don't know how RSS feeds work. Anyone got any suggestions? Do you see what I'm worried about doing it? Or
some of the ones I listen to do only seem to have the last so many, probably 10 or whatever, and some of them they've got all of them. But on the software I use, it doesn't download them all. It downloads the headers for them, but not the whole thing. I don't know.
Yeah, do you understand? Neither, I'm afraid. Do you understand, Jerry, or do you see what I mean? Or?
Well, so you've only got a limited number of items on the RSS feed.
Well, it's default with the WordPress, it only displays 10 by default. It displays 10 items. And RSS feed then obviously picks it up. But I wonder why, and the guy or the person asking is, why can it put more? So I don't know if I can change the RSS feed so that it does it more, or will it, if everyone he'd already subscribed to it, if it adds a new item at the bottom, will everyone's RSS feed then start downloading the previous episodes again?
I see what you mean. Is it like a sort of permalink where, because all RSS is like an XML document from what I understand. So
yeah,
you're worried about say episode 17 becoming episode 7.
No, I'm not worried about that. I don't know. I'm just worried that if I change it to like infinite number or whatever, like 50 or whatever, it will show you 50 items, but will everyone start downloading the ones what already been downloaded? So the top.
Yeah. So somebody is just subscribed now, and then you open it up, and then they'll get a note. Their podcatcher will say, "Oh, new episode available."
Yeah.
And they'll think there's 7 new episodes available.
Mm.
But in actual fact, it's episode 1 to 7.
Yeah.
I don't know what will happen. I see what you're saying though.
I've never really got into RSS feeds, but I found this thing the other day called feedy.com or something, and then you can put sites you visit regularly on it, and you just go to one place, and it downloads all the, it tells you, like, if someone's put a new article on it, it's like, it's really good. So, okay, so we've got all my questions left, or one more email left.
Yeah, we've got one more.
Oh, no. We might have two, actually. Go ahead. I think I might have missed one out. So.
Okay, well, I'll do this one. This was from Lord Drakenblunt. On episode 16, you were talking about virtualization on Linux and how it was pretty much DIY. I'd like to point out two really great products. Proxmox VE is a great system that is very similar to VMware ESXi, also available as Overt. So there's two. So have you heard of any of those two, Jerry? Or?
I haven't actually. No, I have to check those out. I mean, anything that makes the whole process easier is good by me. So it's, yeah. Looks, I mean, I had a quick look at the site, but let's give it a try.
Yeah, it looks really well. I want to have a go. It looks like it's quite good. It looks quite open source, and there's like a web interface you go to add your VMs and stuff, and you can see the console and stuff. So, yeah, thanks for that, Lord. How you ever say that? I'm not very good at saying that. But, yeah, thanks for the email. We'll have a look at that. Maybe come back after they've played it and do a bit of a review on it. So,
excellent. So you found the other last email there, is he? Who's that from? Do you know who that's from?
Simon again.
Oh, is it Simon? Okay, so he says, just finished episode 17, and was thinking about when you talked about different help desk software. You could talk about different methods of storing passwords too, and documentation systems. We use Wiki and store passwords separately, as Wiki is not secure enough, but our password system isn't very sophisticated. So only one person can have wrote access, write access, I presume that means, all the time. And our call engineers have a VPN to access it. So is there a perfect solution where it is secure and easily accessible?
The best of in terms of password manager, I use LastPass. I mean, that's for my personal stuff. So what a LastPass does is it's a service that stores your passwords, although what they say they do, I mean, you know, this is, I obviously trust them enough to store my passwords there, but they store an encrypted version of your password, and then you have the other half of the keys. I think it's done public-private key pair, which we've talked about in previous podcasts. And the public key, and then that's how they make the password, so they don't store the actual password on their servers, or so they say. But it's got to be more secure than using the same username password combination for every website. Maybe getting off the beaten track a bit with that, but that's how I store my passwords. At work we use something called KeePass, which is an open source standalone application rather than sort of cloud based. So that's how we do it at work. And it's got nice things like you can double click on the password and it copies it into the clipboard and then it will delete it after 10 seconds. And so you can paste the password in if you need to. So
I'd like to try some password managers, like LastPass or something like that. I haven't though. I mean, my password manager's in my head. I suppose that's the most secure place you can keep it in.
Yeah.
Mine's in my head at the minute. But I would like to try some, you know, just to experiment with them a bit.
Last,
very clever.
Yeah. LastPass is brilliant. I use it all the time now.
Yeah.
It tells you, like, I've been using it, like, it remembers, like, if you use the same password, it tells you that you use this password somewhere else. So,
I always get it to generate passwords, just a lot more secure. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I normally do. But say something like as a system where you haven't changed the password yet. So if you go to a site which you've been registered before and you haven't had it with LastPass, so you can only go to the site before it remembers it. So what I like is we use a system. We also use a system where is that everyone has their own username and password to get onto the system. So that you've got a logging system, so that you know everyone's not using the same user account, because then you can obviously got an audit trail. If everyone's using the same username and password, you've got no kind of way of tracing it, have you?
Yeah, I mean that's the best practice for Linux as well. You have your own user account, and it can be enabled or disabled to be able to become administrator. But that's all logged, so if someone logs in as themselves and they do something as root, that's always logged. So, like you say, there's an audit trail.
Yeah, so we use the same sort of security system here at work, where it's like a database, and you can only get into it with your AD credentials, and then you don't actually get to see the actual password. It's kind of, you say you right-click and copy it into it, and then it deletes it from the thing, so you no one actually ever gets to see the password. So interestingly, so the other thing is what do you store your information there? Well, we use a thing called we use SharePoint at work to store our information and stuff. So, and I actually set the wiki up for them at my old company, how I know Simon. So it's always good to make documentation, but I don't think there's like a Is it? What's the thing with you have the standard ITIL or whatever is all about making sure you've got configuration management software, isn't it? I went for jobbing it for a couple of months ago, and they were using some really cool configuration management tool where you basically it puts all the information. So yeah, but if you build a server, you put all the information in one thing, so you know that if you ever have to go to rebuild a server, you know who's the owner of it is, etc., etc., and what was on that server. So
A Linux or Windows?
I don't know what it was. It was just like a third-party application that people looked really good. So it's something I'd like to get and is would like to implement one day.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of configuration management software. It's it seems amazing that things like Puppet and so on are just coming around now or in the last few years. Whereas there's been a need for it for decades, probably, at least with Unix stuff.
Yeah, so I was going to say, we're nearly up for the hour now. Email in us about the help desk software. What help desk software? We haven't actually had anyone email us in yet about what help desk software they use. So, email us in if you've got anything to add to that. Anyone got anything else to add in at the end?
I've got nothing else, I don't think, at the moment.
Yeah, we'll talk about my project or this thing I'm working about with doing more research about the migration in the two domains. It's something I always wanted to do. It's something to get my head around. It's quite complicated and a lot to think about. So, as normal, you can email us at mail@appandappenpodcast.co.uk. Find us on Facebook or Google. We'll put the links in the show notes. Until next time, guys, see you soon.
Bye now.
See you.